Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. As a former congressional attorney, I am very conscious of what goes on in Congress, and so are a lot of my sources on the Hill. And a lot of people, I would think, wouldn't even know that Congress was in session this week and last week, doing the kinds of things that you would expect Congress to do. Taking away the court's right to defend the Constitution, installing tax cuts that George Bush promised that he would not install, and helping a variety of corporations get their piece of the taxpayer pork money. They were also doing things like making sure that the 9/11 Commission report would not be implemented, as Bush promised that it would be, and all kinds of interesting other things, including taking away children's health care. Now, a lot of these things are not being discussed on your news. You are seeing, quite rightly, I think, the tremendous dangers going on in Iraq, and I don't mean to minimize those. In fact, we just talked about those yesterday. And, of course, you're hearing the campaign. You're not so much seeing what Bush and Kerry would do in the campaign, but you're hearing the charges and countercharges. You hear Bush calling Kerry a flip-flopper when, I could name 30 flip-flops off the top of my head for George Bush, including a lot of what we're seeing in Congress. If you want to call in, you want to comment, I'd really encourage you to do so today. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. If you just want to dial numbers, it's 877-577-2667. The main two things I want to talk about today are the tax cuts and the plan to make sure that our Constitution cannot be enforced by the courts. They're pretty extreme things going on here, and I think it's important to go through them, particularly the one, the more obscure one, regarding protecting our Constitution. But let's start with the tax cuts. Now, the tax cuts are being put right before an election year on purpose. They are to try to put Democrats in a bind. And the Democrats are in a bind because the Democrats, unlike the Republicans, are fiscal conservatives. Now, you might be surprised to hear the label conservative being applied to Democrats, but a fiscal conservative, of course, is someone who cares about the nation's budget, someone who says that we shouldn't run the huge national credit card so that we owe increasing amounts of our country to Saudi Arabia and China and Japan, but we should pay our debts as they come due. Now, it used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, the Republican Party was the party of fiscal conservatism. Actually, I probably have to go before Ronald Reagan. Let's say 30 years ago. The Republican Party used to be, in Bill Maher's memorable phrase, the Republican Party was the party of the mean old white man who watched your money. Well, now that the Republicans really aren't watching your money anymore, maybe they're just mean old white men. Because what is happening in the current tax bill? The bill itself is relatively uncontroversial. It extends middle-class tax cuts, the end of the marriage penalty, or at least relief from the marriage penalty, alternative minimum tax relief. I'll go through and explain each of these. But the things it does are basically good things. So why am I complaining? Am I complaining because, hey, I just like to complain about Republicans? No. I'm complaining because these were promises by George Bush that he wouldn't do this. Let me explain. When George Bush first began his tax cuts, way back in the beginning of his administration, way back when he said it was done because we had a huge surplus and it would be horrible to let the surplus pay down the deficit. It would be horrible to leave future generations with no debt. It's very important, Bush felt, that we not spend today so that future generations can spend double and triple tomorrow. The surplus, the Clinton surplus, the great economic times were eating at Bush's soul. So he decided that he wanted these tax cuts. And he wanted unprecedented magnitudes of tax cuts. $2 trillion worth of tax cuts. That's a lot of money, even in Washington, given that Clinton had set us on a path where he had given us the highest budget surpluses in modern times, where every year $200-300 billion was going in the positive category, paying down our national debt. George Bush wanted to take six to eight Clinton years, and spend all that in his first year. Well, the Democrats and a few courageous Republicans said there's a limit. We're not going to let you go that far. Many of the Democrats were opposed to the tax cuts. Others, the moderates, said, okay, the people in the middle, we'll let you do it, George Bush, but there's going to be a limit. We're not going to give you the $1.6 trillion that you want. We're only going to give you $1.3 trillion. So Bush was very crafty about how he did the limit. Here's what he did. He took the tax cuts that are pretty indefensible, the things that give huge benefits to corporations, the things that give huge benefits to the richest of Americans, and he extended those far out in the future. And then he took the sweeteners, the saccharin, the sugar, if you will, the part that just about every American would support, extending the child tax cut from $700 to $1,000, doing a marriage penalty reduction, those kinds of things, and he gave them a very short window. He knew that they would expire this year, in election year 2004. And that way he could give $1 trillion plus in tax cuts to the rich and a couple hundred million in tax cuts to the middle class. And then he knew that those tax cuts would be extended. Think about if they'd done the bill differently. Think about if they'd let the middle class tax cuts go on forever and just done the tax cuts for the super wealthy to expire in 2-3 years. Well, Bush knew that Congress was unlikely to extend the deficit to allow for the rich people to continue to get extreme tax cuts. So he very cleverly let the middle class tax cuts expire first, and those are the ones that Congress extended just last week. Congress did what everyone knew they would do, and the Bush tax cuts are not $1.3 trillion. They're now close to $2 trillion. What does this mean? You know, you throw these numbers out, and the Republicans think, and they're probably right, that Americans just can't count that high. You know, it's hard. You know, after 999,999, I think most Americans know the next number is a million. But do they even know how to count to a trillion? A trillion, my friends, for those of you who haven't had a math class lately, a trillion is a million millions. It is a million millions. A billion is 1,000 millions. A trillion is a million millions. So $2 million, $2 million are what George Bush has given away in tax cuts. And again, think about how it's structured. It's very interesting. Using the fact that some would expire, knowing that Congress had to reapprove those to basically make sure that the ones that George Bush didn't want to touch continue. Those, by the way, go all the way till 2009, 2010. Senator Byrd of West Virginia invoked a little-known Senate provision to make sure that nothing could go past 2010 or so. And so George Bush extended the things that were most indefensible to 2010. For example, there's the estate tax cut. The estate tax cut is more than a tax cut. It ends the estate tax completely. And this is something that I've never found a Republican to really be able to defend so well. What the estate tax, in effect, does is it says that if you inherit hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars – okay, that you should pay some tax on it before, say, someone earning $15,000 a year has to pay on their earned income. It's the idea that unearned income isn't as valuable as earned income. George Bush has always consistently believed the opposite. If you work hard and you struggle to pay the rent, if you're holding down three jobs and you got an income of $10,000, $50,000, $100,000, George Bush doesn't think you deserve much of a tax cut. Why? Because you worked hard. And working hard is just not the Republican way. The tax cuts that George Bush wanted, the ones that were extended right from the beginning, 10 years, were things like the estate tax. If you inherit a few hundred million dollars, well, you shouldn't have to pay taxes on that. I mean, $300 million is just not enough to be able to live your entire life without working, Bush thinks. And so, inheritance should not have to be taxed. What other unearned income? Well, capital gains, dividends, other things people do. They put money in investments. They do absolutely nothing. They make the money. Again, if you do nothing and you make money, George Bush does not want you to pay taxes. If you work hard to make money, you got to pay those taxes. And this is clearest on the poor, right? What do the poor pay that the middle class and rich pay much less of? And that's Social Security tax. Well, the poor and actually a lot of the middle class pay Social Security tax. It goes up to about 80-something thousand dollars a year. Over 80 grand, well, you just don't have to pay Social Security tax. So those taxes that focus on the poor, Congress hasn't cut those. Again, the taxes that Bush wants to cut are those that affect multi-millionaires. And the clearest example, and my favorite bill in Congress, although this is 3 years old now, is when Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin said, "All right, Bush, all right, I know you want certain amounts of the inheritance to be tax-free. We Democrats suggested you should get $4 million or $6 million or even $8 million tax-free. But after that, you should have to work for a living. You shouldn't be able to live off the fact that your great-grandfather was extremely wealthy." So Russ Feingold said, "All right, let's make it $100 million. We will accept, will you accept, Republicans, an amendment that says you get $100 million tax-free without earning a penny of it, just because that very rich Uncle Bill Gates died, but after $100 million, will you pay taxes on it?" And, of course, the Republicans said no. They insisted that if you inherit $200 million, you should be able to keep every red penny while we still make those poor people pay the Social Security taxes. And I think it's clear, if you have any question about Republican priorities, look and see what they did last week. Last week, they did not even give the child credits that they gave to middle-class people to poor families. You get $1,000 if you have kids off your taxes. If you're middle class, this was the extension of the middle class tax cut, which really the Democrats didn't oppose. They just wanted to pay for it, which put them in a bind, right? Because it's right before an election year. But they didn't extend it for poor families. The idea, I guess, is poor families are too rich in America, and rich families are too poor. And we have to do what we can to help the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And someone's going to call me up, I'm sure, at 877-57-SCOOP. And if you want to do it, please call in and say, "Mark, this is class warfare. You're pitting the poor against the rich." No, I'm not doing it. The Republican tax policy is doing it. And again, I want to be very clear what happened here. The tax cuts that were extended last week were extended because these were the good stuff. This is the stuff that most Americans wanted, the stuff that Democrats wanted, middle-class tax cuts, because George Bush made them expire this year. So the scandal is not what happened last week. The scandal is what happened in 2001, where the good tax cuts expired this year and the indefensible tax cuts expire way after what would be a Bush second term and hopefully will be a Kerry first term. So if you want to call in, you want to ask about taxes, please do. Toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the deficit and how it's ballooning to impossibly high figures, how George Bush has absolutely broken his promise already to cut the budget deficit in half in his next 5 years. But no one believes George Bush. No one accepts his word. Everyone knows he's lying when he says he's going to cut the budget deficit. At least everyone in Congress knows that. But does the press ever report it? Does the press, which is suggesting allegations that John Kerry shot himself to get a Purple Heart, ever go into the fact that George Bush is not just lying when he says he's going to cut the budget deficit, is not just the biggest spending president in American history, is not just the least fiscal conservative of any president in American history, but the fact is he knows it. He knows it. He gets the estimates, and he still goes ahead. He still is bringing our debt. It's going to double, folks. It's going to double from $4 trillion today to $8 trillion. And that's without the extension of things past 2010. $8 trillion. Again, that's 8 million millions. Or maybe it'll make it, you'll think about it better. It's about almost 30,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. So when you pay your credit card bills, just remember, if you're a family of four, George Bush has made you owe another $120,000 to the U.S. government. We'll come back with more of the Inside Scoop. I do want to get into the really more extreme even than Bush's tax cuts, and that is Bush's plan to overrule the United States Constitution by not allowing the courts to enforce it. We'll get to that and more, and your calls, 877-57-SCOOP. We appreciate your calls. 877-57-SCOOP. Or your contributions to the blog right after this.
Governor Jeb Bush is out to make his state of Florida the next Florida. In 2000, Jeb used such crude political tactics as illegally purging voter lists to help engineer his brother's 537-vote victory in that election. And now, here he goes again. As one peer of Florida's GOP establishment candidly puts it, a Democrat can't win a statewide election in Florida without a high turnout of African Americans. It's no secret that the name of the game for Republicans is to restrain that turnout as much as possible. The Orlando League of Voters can attest to that. This African-American civic group has played a big role in turning Orlando from a Republican stronghold into a city that increasingly votes Democratic. Their reward for getting involved in the Democratic process is to have Jeb Bush's state police suddenly come knock, knock, knocking on the doors of some 50 of the League's grassroots leaders. These leaders, mostly elderly black women, find it frightening to be confronted in their homes by armed troopers interrogating them about their electoral participation. They're not charged with any crime. Instead, police say they're investigating vague allegations that some voter fraud might have occurred in this spring's mayoral election. Yet Jeb's own state police honcho wrote in a May letter that, quote, there was no basis to support the allegations, and he declared this matter closed. But it has not closed. Police now say the chief's letter was poorly worded, and the intimidating in-home interrogations continued this summer as the presidential election heated up. Jeb's police action is creating a blanket of fear among the league's volunteers who worry that their perfectly legal efforts will land them in jail. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course Jeb says that there's no political motive involved, but when asked how long the Orlando investigation will go on, police say it might continue right through November 2nd.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what's going on in Congress, because, hey, no one else is talking about it. And that's, I guess, one of my roles as a former congressional staff attorney, is to let you know what's going on in Congress. And, of course, the major thing that's going on is the extension of Bush tax cuts and a really unique proposal to take away the Supreme Court's right to enforce the Constitution. If you want to call in, please feel free to do so. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can always contribute to the blog. The web blog, all you have to do is go to www.radioinsidescoop.com and add your comments, and I'm going to briefly read some of these comments right now. Rick writes, "Both Democrats and Republicans know freedom isn't free. It's too bad that Republicans are not willing to help pay for it." James writes, "The Republicans always use the farm example to defend the estate tax, family farms being taken away, but this rarely, if ever, happens. Even under the old law, family farms were exempt up to $10 million. And James, I don't know of any family farm, worth more than $100 million. That's quite a family." Fred writes in New York City, "I think if you take a clear look at the history of our founding, you'll see that inheritance taxes were deliberately devised to prevent the accumulation of wealth in family dynasties. One of the big things we were trying to get away from was aristocracy. That is, unless you follow the same line of thinking that Hamilton and Adams followed." Thank you for your comment, Fred. I want to go right to the phones now. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine.
This is Ed from New York, and I agree with you, caller from New York City, that the estate tax has really been a real shame. And the real problem that I see is this, that unfortunately, with the rosy picture of the war in Iraq, people are forgetting, A, about the congressional races, B, they're forgetting about the domestic agenda of the Bushes, and as a result, the Bush family, and I include his father in that as well, are rewarding their friends in the oil business. I mean, Halliburton is stealing blind. I was watching either NBC or CBS News over the weekend, and I noticed that people who are willing to risk their lives in Iraq because of the great unemployment here, because they're getting paid $80,000 to $100,000 a year to drive a truck. That's crazy.
Well, what's interesting about that also is that we are paying very large amounts to people who are not in our military. To the military contractors are getting these huge sums, people like Halliburton, whereas our soldiers, the people who sign up for duty, the people that are, you know, under the control of the commander-in-chief, are getting far less. Interestingly, there was a provision to extend benefits to soldiers in the combat zones in this year's tax bill just last week. And the Republicans extended their tax cuts for 5 years. They'd only extend the combat pay for veterans for 2 years.
Why do you think that is, Mark?
Well, I think it's because they know that 2 years from now, it's the same idea. You make the most popular things expire early, and the least popular things expire a long time from now. And the reason for that is the Republicans know that 2 years from now, everyone's going to vote to extend combat veteran pay for another 2 years. And that way, they can say, well, the bill didn't cost as much as we say. It only cost $2 trillion. It didn't cost $2.2 trillion. It's really the same thing they did back in 2001. They put the unpopular tax cuts going on for 10 years, things like the estate tax removal, and then they took the popular tax cuts, like $300 a person, and they expired those early. And that way they could say, oh, we only spent $1.3 trillion, when everyone knew that the most popular things were going to be extended. One of the secrets about Congress is that if they give a tax cut and it expires, it never really expires. And if you vote to deny the increase, if you vote to deny the expiration, then it's called a tax increase. That's one of the things that they do to try to punish the Democrats.
I noticed also recently that a bunch of corporations have been indicted with regard to Tom DeLay. Mr. DeLay, it seems, was running like a slush fund, and I'm not even exactly sure. But somehow or other, Mr. DeLay didn't get indicted down in Texas. And I'm wondering, you think that's as a result of his own political pull to save his own neck?
Well, it's actually very interesting. My impression is that, although I can't prove it, is that Tom DeLay is an unindicted co-conspirator. In other words, he's someone who they want to indict the lower people at the bottom first to try to get to. There is an ethics complaint filed by Congressman Chris Bell, Democrat of Texas, against Tom DeLay. And it went to the Ethics Committee. In fact, we did a whole show on this a few months back. And the Ethics Committee has now come down, surprise, surprise, in a bipartisan manner, with all the Democrats saying it should be investigated and all the Republicans saying it shouldn't be investigated. Interesting, then, is in essence, the Ethics Committee is now meaningless, because even where you have indictments in Texas, the Republicans are saying, we don't care if it's criminal. We don't care what he's done. We are not going to investigate one of our own, no matter what crimes he's done. And whether it's the case of Tom DeLay, whether it's in case of the bribery for Nick Smith of Michigan, who was bribed to vote Bush's way on the Medicare bill, the Ethics Committee in Congress is really doing nothing. So unfortunately, the only people we can rely on are our criminal statutes, like what's going on in Texas.
Mark, do you think that there's a chance that the Democrats could either take over the House or the Senate?
I'll tell you, it's tough. The reason it's tough is that in the House, because of Tom DeLay, in fact, because of his machinations, they get 6 more seats. Not based on a single extra vote, but just based on Tom DeLay's machinations. Here's what he did. First of all, in Texas, corporations are not allowed to give donations to political campaigns. It hasn't been allowed in Texas for more than 100 years, and I think it's actually a good law designed to keep out big money influence in government. So the first thing Tom DeLay's associates did, and I'll get to your question of Democrats controlling Congress because it all relates to this. The first thing Tom DeLay did is he got a bunch of corporations to give his associates money. Then they laundered the money. That's what they're being accused of in Texas. And they spent a ton of money on Texas legislative races in the local House and Senate in Texas. This began back in the 90s. Once that was done, then they came in and they gerrymandered in the state of Texas. Basically, not if everyone in Texas votes the same way that they did 4 years ago, the Republicans get 6 more seats. Because gerrymandering, as we've discussed on this program, it isn't about democracy. It's about drawing the lines around voters, taking all the Democrats and putting them in a few districts that are 100% Democratic, and then making other districts 60 Republican, 40 Democrats, so that way, at the end of the day, you get a lot more Democratic representatives, even when the same number of people vote. And Tom DeLay was so insistent on doing this that when the Democrats in Texas tried to stop it by leaving the state, he actually had the Department of Homeland Security track down their plane, another gross violation of federal law. But John Ashcroft and the Justice Department, I don't think, will prosecute Tom DeLay. And hopefully it will happen down in Texas. That may be the only place he will be, because Congress doesn't seem to be doing anything. But I think at the end of the day, those 6 seats in Texas, plus gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in Colorado, it's going to make it very, very hard for the Democrats to take the House. As for the Senate, the Republicans are 51 to 49 ahead. Most of the seats that are up tend to be in the red states, not the blue states. It's going to be tough, but I think there is a chance, a slight one, that Democrats could get 50 seats, and then if Kerry becomes president, then the vice president, Edwards, would break the tie. Barack Obama is clearly going to win Illinois. That's 1 seat for the Democrats, but we've got trouble holding on to seats in places like South Carolina and Louisiana. So I think it's going to be
tough.
What
about Colorado?
Well, Colorado, I think we can win. That's a very close one. Colorado, of course, you have Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who Republican, who is retiring. It's Pete Coors, the Coors magnet, if you will, from the beer community, from the beer industry. He's the Republican, and he's slightly behind the Democrat, Attorney General Salazar. I think we can pick up Colorado. We've got to hold on to Florida, too. We got Betty Caster there running against Mel Martinez.
What's the Florida race look like, Mark?
I think we're going to win in Florida. I think we got to – both Florida and Colorado are extremely close. I think we're going to win in Florida. I think actually there's a slightly better chance that Caster will win than Kerry will win in Florida. I'd say she's about 2 points ahead of Kerry. So if Kerry squeaks in and makes and wins Florida, which I've argued on this program many times, that's what it takes to win the election, then I think Betty Caster will be senator. But that won't be a switch. That will just be replacing Bob Graham, Senator Bob Graham, who's a Democrat, with another Democrat.
Mark, you know, speaking of Florida, that reminds me that I read in someplace, and I can't remember where, that most of the hurricane has hit in the Republican area of Florida.
Yeah, there's a wonderful email going around. I've gotten it from a few listeners that shows a map of Florida, and it shows the counties that voted for Gore and the counties that voted for Bush. And the title of the map is God Doesn't Want Bush to Win. And it shows the hurricanes, and each of the four hurricanes are going through the Republican counties and are not going through the Democratic counties. So I don't know if the Floridians appreciate that map too much, but it is an amusing coincidence, if you will, that the hurricanes do seem to be hitting the Republican areas, particularly when, actually, if you remember back in the gay marriage debate, Jerry Falwell said that if Florida allows gay people to adopt, well, there will be – Orlando will be destroyed. If Disneyland allows gay people to go to Disneyland, then Orlando will be destroyed by hurricanes. And it seems that the Democratic areas are not getting hit, only the Republican areas. So that's an interesting thing.
Wolf Blitzer today on his show asked the Democratic congressman from Florida, and I don't remember the gentleman's name, what was the effect of the hurricane going through more of the Republican areas than the Democratic areas. And he didn't answer the question, but if I can put in my thoughts,
sure.
My thought would be that if your house is being torn up and you're trying to fight with the insurance adjuster and you need a FEMA loan and you're in an area where that is going on, you're probably less likely to go to the polls and vote on election day than if things turned out relatively well for you.
Well,
I hope I'm right. Anyway.
Well, it's an interesting theory. It may well be true. Of course, merely by stating the theory, people are going to accuse you and me and Democrats of profiting off people's misery. But as a sheer political fact, I think you may be right, Ed. And I'll tell you, I do think Florida will decide this election, and I think Florida will be less than 1% for the winner. And if that's a few tenths of a percentage point, that may well make the difference. Hey, Ed, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate that. We're going to go to commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the budget deficit and then move on and discuss what's going on where the president and the Congress actually want to remove the right of the Supreme Court to decide constitutional issues. They still want the Supreme Court choosing our president. They still want the Supreme Court being the ultimate voter in the elections. They think the Supreme Court should do all these political things. But when it comes to judicial items, they just don't want the Supreme Court to have that power. Very interesting. We're going to go into the constitutional issues of this when I get back. If you want to call in, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP.
Wouldn't you be a little skeptical if you took your car in for a routine checkup and the repair shop said it had found a mysterious and costly problem deep in the engine that, quote, needs fixing, even though you can't detect any problem at all? Welcome to the shady world of today's Social Security mechanics, including politicos of both parties and a phalanx of banking lobbyists. They're telling us in the direst terms that there's a major problem deep in the Social Security system that must be fixed right away. The fix is going to be costly, they solemnly inform us. It'll require raising people's retirement age to as high as 70, cutting the monthly payments for all retired workers, and even privatizing part or all of this public safety net for retirees. But we must accept these fixes, they warn, or the whole system will sputter and die. BS alert, BS alert. Of all government programs, including the bloated, fraud-ridden Pentagon, Social Security is least in need of fixing. It's the most efficient program we have, requiring a mere 1% of its total budget for administrative costs. And even the political mechanics who want to mess with the program admit that Social Security is perfectly sound and capable of paying full benefits to future retirees through at least 2042. What insurance company or bank can make that claim? And with only minor adjustment, the system is solid through 2075, long after most of today's fixers will be dead. There is one fix, however, that would guarantee the soundness of Social Security in perpetuity. Raise the current $88,000 income cap so that the salaries, bonuses, stock gains, and other wealth of the elites are also subject to Social Security taxes, rather than keeping the burden solely on the wages of low-income and middle-class working folks. This is Jim Hightower saying, to push for this simple and fair reform, call Campaign for America's Future, 202-955-5665.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking about what's going on in Congress. As a former attorney for the House Judiciary Committee and the House Homeland Security Committee, I watch congressional issues pretty closely, but what's mostly going on is in the budget. They are extending the Bush tax cuts that they promised just 3 years ago they would not extend because they said it would go right into the deficit. The Democrats support the extensions, which are mostly good things, things like child tax credits and making sure the alternative minimum tax goes up in relation to incomes and inflation, but they want it to be paid for. The Republicans insist that it not be paid for, that in fact our children and our children's children should pay for those things that they can't even vote on today. And so we've taken a projected $5 trillion tax cut, $5 trillion surplus in the budget by Bill Clinton when he left office. And before yesterday, it was a $5 trillion deficit. But now, according to the new Congressional Budget Office figures, it's an $8 trillion deficit. So George Bush, in 4 years, has spent $13 trillion. $13 trillion. When you think about the fact that the highest budget surplus we've ever had is Bill Clinton's, which is about $250 billion a year, it will take 52 years of Clinton-like surpluses to pay off Bush's debt. $13 trillion. Or, to do the math, it comes down to about $40,000 for every American man, woman, and child. That's taking away Bush's $5 trillion, adding $8 trillion. So, what happened to the Party of Fiscal Conservatives? Well, there are still some principal conservatives out there. I know the Cato Institute is very unhappy about what's going on, but it's very hard for Democrats to vote against it. It is an election year. These things are popular. And, you know, it's kind of like anyone that's irresponsible. If somebody offers candy to a baby and you try to take the candy away, the baby will like the candy giver more than the candy taker. It's very hard to be fiscally responsible, and it's particularly hard for the Democrats to do it when the Republicans are so fiscally irresponsible. What I find most grating, though, is not the fact that there's a party of responsibility and a party of irresponsibility. That's America's choices. What I find grating is that the Republicans still claim the Democrats are the party of big spending, the party of deficit government, when anyone with their eyes open can see that there's one party looking out for the future. That's the Democrats, and another party who's broken into the Social Security Trust Fund, taken all the money and spent it, you know, 5, 10, 20 times over. I want to read some of your blog comments here. James has written a number of very interesting comments. One, he writes that a brown route truck driver gets about $100,000 a year, while the foot soldier who protects him gets about $25,000. That's absolutely right, James. And I'll tell you, it doesn't make the foot soldier too happy. And we wonder why there are morale problems in the military. One of them is when someone who can quit his job is being paid four times what you're getting when you're not allowed to quit. Remember, a lot of people after September 11th, after Afghanistan attacked us, joined up in the military because they wanted to fight the war. They wanted to defend their country from the people that attacked us. And they didn't know they'd be sent to some place where no one attacked us. And if you wonder about whether we're going to need a draft, just look at the military figures and the National Guard figures. And as long as George Bush wants to stay the course, I don't see how we can avoid a draft. Unless that is we, I don't know, increase soldiers' pay to at least what we're paying people at Halliburton, which will be a lot more in the deficit. James also writes, it's a Karl Rove trick. Bush can go around and say how he just kept the tax cuts, the one that Kerry wants to stop. Yes, I agree. It is a great Karl Rove trick to take the tax cuts and make them expire. And then if you let them expire, if you simply vote not to change the law, that's a tax increase. And indeed, many of these so-called tax increases that Bush has blamed on Kerry is Kerry voting against a proposal to do a tax cut, usually for corporate interests, which, by the way, got $13 billion in this tax bill. James also on the blog gives a way to help with the Senate, to give money to a cash-strapped candidate in Ohio. And he goes on to say, I think people not voting is a loss for everyone, whether it helps the Democrats or not. I agree. James is referring to the caller, Ed, who talked about the fact that the hurricanes might just help the Democrats because they hit mostly Republican areas and people may not vote. I agree, James. I think we should make it easier for everyone to vote. And that's why I wouldn't have these felons lists. I wouldn't have all these barriers to young people. You know, young people in MTV poll are overwhelmingly for John Kerry. And so that you can expect the Republicans to make it very difficult for young people to vote. And I'm going to be talking about that when I have tomorrow a new college Republican, this one the state chairman of Maine, come on air on Election Tuesday. But I want to get to the other topic, and that is the Constitution of the United States, because there's something the Republicans are doing that's particularly pernicious, and if you don't understand all the ins and outs of it, you might not even follow it. The Republicans want to defend God and want to defend the flag, and they want to be seen as defending God and the flag because they seem to believe that if they're not there, no one will pray to God and no one will wave the American flag. By the way, if you want to call in and discuss any of this, the lines are open. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. So there already was a vote when there was a court ruling striking under God from the Pledge of Allegiance. And when that happened by the Ninth Circuit, the Congress voted some 400-something to about three, with I think 13 abstentions, about 400-something to three, that they should keep under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. I have to tell you, I think all 400-something were wrong, because I frankly don't like the idea that the government decides if little children pray to God or not. I believe in the separation of church and state. I happen to think that was a right court decision. But I can understand in a religious country how members of Congress, overwhelmingly Republicans and Democrats, felt they had to vote to keep under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. The case, of course, went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court dodged the issue. They ruled that the person who brought the case, Michael Newdow, that he wasn't the proper custodian for his daughter. He was divorced from his wife, and therefore he didn't have standing, didn't have permission to challenge the issue, and so therefore the Pledge of Allegiance remains. And I think the Supreme Court is recognizing that our Constitution required, or at least some may have recognized, that our Constitution required separation of church and state. It says Congress shall pass no law establishing a religion. And again, what is the Pledge of Allegiance but a Congress-passed law establishing religion? So the Supreme Court, in order not to rule on this issue, which is very unpopular but is in our Constitution, found a technicality and got rid of it. What the House did, though, just last week, is they're passing legislation to make sure that the courts have no power to even decide this issue. And it's a bit complex, but I want to explain to you exactly what's going on here. So we're going to have to go to commercial break soon. I'll begin it now. But I want to explain to you exactly what's going on, because it's the kind of thing that can really come back and hurt us. The short answer before I go to break, and I'll give you the longer answer after break, the short answer after break is that when you have a law passed by Congress, passed by a state, that is against our United States Constitution, it is the role of the Supreme Court to say that. We do not have a pure majoritarian democracy in America, and actually that's okay with me. Basically, as you know from your social studies classes, the Constitution trumps the majority. If the majority of people want to declare Christianity the state religion, as they well might, the Constitution says no. There's a separation of church and state. Congress can't do that. If the majority of people want to deny blacks the right to vote, and that may well have been true in the South in the 60s, the Constitution says no. You have to have equal protection under the laws. It's not just a question of a majority rules. We also have minority rights. Many of those are found in the Bill of Rights. For example, the whole world may think that you've committed a crime, but unless the government proves that you've committed a crime and gives you the right to have an attorney, the right to challenge witnesses, not to have secret hearings, well, you can't be convicted of that crime. And again, the Bush administration, with popular support, maybe even a majority, is trying very hard to overrule the Bill of Rights, to take away protections of due process. But you can't do that. The Constitution says you can't do that. So then comes the question of whose role is it to enforce the Constitution? And ever since 200 years ago, in the great opinion of Marbury versus Madison, the United States Supreme Court has asserted itself as the body that decides when a law violates the Constitution. When we come back, I want to give you a little bit more of that history and then tell you what Congress is doing to take away a right the Supreme Court has had for 200 years to overturn congressional laws. It's one step closer to dictatorship, and believe it or not, it won a majority in the House of Representatives. We'll talk about it when we come back. If you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP.
I bring you tidings of great joy. At last, our Congress critters have done something tangible to lift people up from the economic doldrums. They've raised wages in America. You're not silly enough to think for a moment that Congress would raise your wages, are you? No, no, Nanette. For the past several years, they've kept the minimum wage in our country stuck at the paltry poverty level of $5.15 an hour. It's their wages that they've just raised. Again. By again, I refer to the fact that this is the sixth pay hike that our lawmakers have bestowed upon themselves in the past 6 years. This time, the members will pocket an extra $4,000 each, raising their gross pay to about $162,000 a year. Of course, congressional leaders don't do such dirty work directly. Instead, these steady increases, now totaling some $25,000 over the 6 years, have come surreptitiously. Each year, an automatic congressional increase is tucked deep inside the mammoth appropriation bill for the Treasury Department, a bill that always passes. So members always get a raise, unless they choose to deny themselves by specifically voting to remove the automatic hike. Thus far, they've shown remarkable restraint in this regard. One bold member who keeps trying to say no to this help-yourself dip into the taxpayer's gravy is Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah. Again this year, Matheson called for a vote on the $4,000 increase. But by a tally of 235 to 170, his colleagues rejected his procedural motion, thus avoiding even having to cast a direct public vote on their money grab. This is Jim Hightower saying, at a time when the wages of average Americans have fallen in terms of buying power, it's good to know whose side your Congress critter is on. To learn how your member of Congress voted on Matheson's attempt at honesty, call Taxpayers for Common Sense, 1-800-TAXPAYER.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Your oldest has just turned driving age. Time to add him to your policy. So you get in your car, drive down to your insurance company. Hunt for a space, double park, get a parking ticket, get in a fight with the meter maid, get thrown in jail, meet a guy named Wally. Wait a minute. This is just a bad dream. You've got GEICO. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can do all that car insurance stuff online. Oh, that was a close one.
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO. Online at GEICO.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what's going on in Congress while everyone's focused on the election and the war in Iraq. And if you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. When we went to commercial, I was talking about the Pledge Protection Act, the act that the Republicans are going to go at election time and say, Democrats, if you voted against this act, you're against the Pledge of Allegiance, you're against America, you're against God and apple pie. But what does this act do? This act that the Republicans are doing in election year to try to make the Democrats look bad. What does it do? It takes away the right of the Supreme Court to decide whether a law is unconstitutional or not. Now, this has never been done before, and I want to go back and give a little bit of history here. It is important, and I think that Fred in New York City raises some great questions on the blog. And let me read to you his second question first. He says, from where does the Supreme Court derive the authority to overturn laws? He cites the clause in the Constitution, and he says, at what point did the court start tossing out laws? I can't find something I can point to that says the Supreme Court can declare laws unconstitutional. Granted, I'm not a lawyer. Well, Fred, it's a great question, and it's one that actually every first-year law student in constitutional law will study. Where does this power derive from? Well, let's go back and think about how our system works. We have a constitution that can overrule a majority's law, right? I mean, we have a constitution. If the Bill of Rights, if the amendments, if the restrictions mean anything, it means that if Congress passes a law that if it's against the constitution, you know, it overrides the law. Now, you might respond, but wait a minute. Every elected official, the president, the members of Congress, down everyone in the state legislature, down to your local dog catcher probably, but certainly everyone in state or federal legislatures has to say an oath to uphold and defend the United States Constitution. So Congress shouldn't even pass laws that are unconstitutional in the first place. The president shouldn't sign laws that are unconstitutional in the first place. And if that were your argument, I would strongly agree with you. I believe the founders wanted everyone in the constitutional system to look at the Constitution and not to vote for laws that would be against the Constitution. And so I think it's everyone's role to say, and what am I doing? Is it a part of the Constitution? But the Supreme Court declared way back in the early 1800s, back when Chief Justice Marshall was the Chief Justice. And this was actually right at the end of the John Adams presidency, right before the Thomas Jefferson presidency in 1801. And the court held in the very famous opinion of Marbury versus Madison, which is probably the most well-known opinion for any law student. Ask anyone in law school what Marbury versus Madison is, and they should know this opinion backwards and forwards. The Supreme Court said, look, it's the role of courts to interpret the law. That's been their role for centuries. And therefore, it is inherently the province of the court to say what the law is. And Marbury versus Madison is always put down as the foundation of our courts in America. You're right, Fred. It's not explicitly in the Constitution that the courts can declare a law unconstitutional. But if they can't, the question is who can? Is Congress, is the president, are these institutions that just pass the law likely to declare it unconstitutional? It makes sense in a constitutional system that the people ruling on the law would be whether it's constitutional or not, would be the least majoritarian branch. The branch of the government where judges are not elected. They're not directly chosen by the people, and so they can sit back and they can rule against majoritarian tendencies. The founders believed that politics, deciding the president of the United States, that should be something that should be done by voters, at least through the Electoral College, that senators House of Representatives, that when you vote for your political leaders, that's something that should be done by majority. But when it came to individual rights, that was something that courts can do. But you're absolutely right, Fred. It's not explicitly in the Constitution. It is, however, a principle that has existed for more than 200 years in America. And I haven't heard any Republicans or anyone specifically say they don't want this, the Supreme Court to decide cases under the Constitution. They just want to now take away piece by piece. They think, oh, well, the Pledge of Allegiance is that popular. We'll take away the Supreme Court's right to decide on that question. But when you do that, you open the door to all kinds of other questions. I mean, why should the Supreme Court have any right to challenge, for example, picking up American citizens and putting them in jail indefinitely, which the Bush administration has done, and the Supreme Court has challenged? After all, Congress can just turn around and pass a law that says, hey, you know, you can't rule on that either. It's a very, very dangerous precedent. And Fred goes on to say, even if this were legal and a court was prohibited from reviewing the pledge, what would prevent a court from reviewing this law? Isn't this the same realm of passing a law with a clause claiming it goes into law without a presidential signature, and it's illegal for a president to veto it? Fred, I agree with you. I think this law itself is unconstitutional. I think it is unconstitutional to tell the Supreme Court you have no authority to determine the Constitution. Because I think in that sense it really destroys the third branch of government. It destroys the checks and balances that are in the Constitution. And what would be very interesting, I think, is if you get into this kind of battle where you have Congress telling the courts, hey, you have no power here. The court saying, yes, we do have power here. Who decides? Well, what can the court do? The court could declare that anyone that doesn't follow its ruling, they're held in contempt. In contempt of court. And can order their marshals to go out and arrest anyone who doesn't follow the court's orders. Put them in jail for contempt of court. Well, okay. But then what if the president orders the military to say, don't follow the marshals? In essence, the checks and balances in our Constitution have enforcement. They have powers that back it up. And what the Congress is really doing is they're laying down the law and saying, you know what, Supreme Court, we don't care what you think. We're not going to follow it. There is precedent, unfortunately, for that too in American history. Many know that in the 1820s, President Andrew Jackson went out on what's now called the Trail of Tears and massacred or exiled all the Native American tribes living in his home state of Tennessee. And the Cherokees and the Choctaws and the Chickasaws who'd lived in Tennessee for hundreds, if not thousands of years, were all forced out on their Trail of Tears to go to Oklahoma. The Supreme Court in the 1820s ruled that Jackson violated the law, that there were treaties between the United States and these Indian nations, and Andrew Jackson had no right to force them out of Tennessee. To which point President Jackson turned around and said, okay, the Chief Justice has set down his law. Where is his army to enforce it? And Andrew Jackson quite openly violated the law because he knew that the Supreme Court didn't have the military to enforce it. So in essence, that is what Congress is now saying. We don't care about the Constitution. We don't care about the Supreme Court. Where's your army to enforce it? Interestingly, when the Supreme Court did intervene in something it had no power to intervene in, no question of the Bill of Rights, but where it intervened in a political decision deciding the President of the United States, there, Republicans didn't complain. So here you have a branch of government that's supposed to rule on judicial things and not on political things, and according to the Republicans, they want it to rule on political things, overrule the people when they don't get the president they want, but not rule to protect people's rights. It's a very dangerous thing. And as James points out, I don't know if the court does have the power to throw out a law, but they're the only ones with the power to enforce a law. And since the Constitution overrules all other laws in the land, then any law that is contrary to the Constitution should not be upheld. And since the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land, all other courts will listen to this ruling and will not uphold the law. It's called checks and balances. But as Rick points out, it sure looks like Bush is liking the whole dictator idea more and more. By limiting the power of the courts to rule on the constitutionality of laws, if this happens, then we as a nation have just burned the Constitution. We'd be allowing one person, the president, to interpret the Constitution. This way they can pass laws that infringe on the rights of people. After the courts are rendered obsolete, next will be Congress, and bingo, we have a dictatorship. I have to agree with Rick that this is a very dangerous precedent, and it's the kind of thing that starts out slow. Defending the Pledge of Allegiance is not that big a deal. Frankly, I don't think Under God should be there. I realize that most Americans disagree with me, and I think that the way I see it's in the Constitution. But this is a very, very small thing in the scheme of things. But to say that the President and Congress don't have to uphold the Constitution anymore, to say that their oaths to uphold the Constitution are not relevant anymore, and that the courts have no power to overlook what they're doing, no power to look over their shoulder and say, hey, you know what? That's unconstitutional. That is extreme behavior. And this is what Congress is doing when you're not looking. They're actually taking away constitutional rights. It's shocking stuff, but I'll tell you this. You won't see it in the attack ads. When the attack ads come on TV, you'll see, hey, the Democratic candidate voted against the Pledge of Allegiance. Isn't he awful? And no one will remark upon the fact that a Republican candidate voted against the American Constitution. And in my mind, if I have to choose between defending the American Constitution and defending the